Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument is United States versus Spano. Mr. LaPuma.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Frank LaPuma on behalf of Emil Shulo. This argument is presented on his behalf as well as on behalf of the other appellants. I would like to focus my argument, Your Honors, on the district court's denial of the motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, as well as the court's denial of the motion for an evidentiary hearing dealing with the government's principal witnesses' substance abuse issues, that is Frank Taylor, during the period of the offense conduct as well as the trial proceedings. I would like to focus initially on Judge Grady's memorandum opinion in this matter, which is attached to Shulo's brief as Exhibit B in the appendix, and specifically on certain errors and oversights in Judge Grady's memorandum opinion. Specifically, Judge Grady's opinion focused on specifically Frank Taylor's motion and affidavit only. And it was our argument that that alone was sufficient to prompt at least an evidentiary hearing. However, through subsequent defense investigation, we found that on at least three occasions, Frank Taylor had tested positive for the presence of opiates during random urine drops, two within 1 year of the trial and one 7 days after his trial testimony. Now, additionally, we obtained documents from the United States Probation Office, and those documents revealed, among other things, that Taylor was referred to a drug treatment program while he was under their supervision. We did receive also a report that was redacted in nature, but it was in the context of a paragraph that discussed Taylor's positive drug tests. And we made a motion for production of that document in an unredacted form, as well as additional probation reports. None of that was ever disclosed. We never received any of that information during the trial, at sentencing. We only got it after Frank Taylor filed his motion and supporting affidavit. And even then, we don't have all of the materials that should have been made available to us. Now, the government wants to talk about those positives as being false positives. The problem is, Your Honors, is we never, ever had an opportunity to challenge that in court because we didn't know that he was testing positive. And we know based on the materials he submitted, as well as the documents from the Bureau of Prisons, and more importantly, from an independent body, a body that works for the court, documents from the probation office which revealed abuse and use of drugs and tests for drugs. And I'm talking many different types of drugs, some prescribed.
Abuse when he was testifying?
Judge, there was some evidence from the probation reports that 7 days after he testified, he tested positive for the presence of opiates. That information was not provided to us until post-conviction, while this appeal was pending, as a matter of fact. Now, Judge Grady also sort of hamstrung us on this particular motion because he makes reference in his opinion to the fact that co-counsel who represented John Legiglio, his name's Alan Ackerman, tried to do a cross-examination of Frank Taylor during the trial in the presence of the jury, and the government objected properly because such a matter should have been brought up to the court's attention prior to doing that way. But then when the jury was excused, there was quite a lot of dialogue between the court, the prosecution, and Mr. Ackerman. And admittedly, Ackerman, it said, he did not have evidence that Taylor was using drugs during the period of the offense conduct. He didn't know any better. He was relying on the discovery materials from the government. However, the district court, Judge Grady suggested, and Alan Ackerman agreed, that what should happen is we should have a offer of proof with Taylor being a witness outside the presence of jury.
So your argument is Taylor was using drugs while he was testifying?
Personally, Judge, I cannot make that representation to the court. I can't. All I can talk about is what the test revealed and the fact that additional materials should have been provided to us. However, the court denied that and didn't allow us to have an evidentiary hearing. And I see my light is on, but I just want to finish this point.
The judge found that he was perfectly lucid during his testimony in the trial.
Yes, Judge, that is true. The judge also found that Mr. Taylor was equally responsive to questions from the government and the defense. However, I would take some issue with that because quite often Taylor's responses were, I don't know, I don't remember. So,
there are people answer questions that way. I mean, they're on drugs.
Agreed. However, Judge, if I just may return to this particular point, the government strenuously objected to the fact of allowing an inquiry of Taylor about his drug use and said the government or defense was acting in bad faith, did not have a good faith basis. Grady initially was going to have the proffer or the offer of proof and then said, I will make the very rare ruling that you don't even have standing to make an offer of proof, and followed the government's suggestion that it be denied, and also telling the jury, which Judge Grady did, that he made an inquiry into this issue, and he found that it did not merit any further questioning. The jury should disregard it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lightfinger. Mr. Rubenstein?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Corey Rubenstein on behalf of Defendant Schneider. Your Honors, I just am going to make a very, very brief comment regarding Booker and this Court's procedure post-Booker as outlined in Palladino. Obviously, we had filed our Booker briefs before Palladino had been decided. We haven't had an opportunity to address the procedure in Palladino. We acknowledge Palladino, although we respectfully disagree with the procedure. There is one point, however, in the procedure that we think needs clarification, and we think this Court can address in a way that would not be inconsistent with the case. And that is, Palladino suggests that the defendants will receive a limited remand, at which point Judge Grady will determine whether, if he had known that he can take cognizance of the other 3553 factors, whether he would have given a lower sentence. And Palladino's language is in those sort of unequivocal terms, would have given a different sentence. Judge Ripple, in his dissent...
Lower or higher?
Obviously, we would be making the argument there would be a lower sentence. In his dissent, Judge Ripple noted what he thought were infirmities with this procedure. In particular, you're asking a district court judge to, in essence, prejudge the evidence to determine whether he would give a different sentence based on evidence the judge has not heard.
No.
It is, Judge, except if this were a post-Booker sentencing, the judge would know that there are factors that are relevant to sentencing other than just the guideline factors. And the judge would be able to, and the defendant would be able to...
Is there something concrete that you're going to say?
About what we would do at sentencing?
If you want us to agree with Judge Ripple...
No, I don't, Judge.
We're past that point. Is there something concrete you want?
There is, Judge. My request is that this court make it clear that Judge Grady does not need to say unequivocally that he would have imposed a lower sentence, just that, given the other sentencing factors, he might impose a different sentence if he had the...
Look, we know that in every case the judge might have imposed a different sentence. There's a probability greater than zero of that in every case. Indeed, there's a probability greater than zero that the judge would impose a different sentence if the judge had had something different for breakfast. So that can't possibly be the legal standard.
Well, the legal standard can be that the judge, knowing what the factors are, and the judge wouldn't do this in the abstract. The judge would point to a specific factor and would say, I would need to hear evidence or further argument or have further proceedings on this particular factor in this particular issue. But given the summary procedure set forth in Palladino, that's not possible. And I think under those circumstances, the district court judge would be able to make that representation to the Seventh Circuit and would be able to receive a remand, a full remand for resentencing.
Look, it's possible for the judge to say that, you know, if he had known that the guidelines were advisory, he would have inquired into X, Y, and Z, and he didn't. You can argue that to the judge.
He's
not required to hear your evidence, though.
No, he isn't.
I consider it was irrelevant. He's not interested in, you know, the early childhood upbringing of the defendants.
But he might be, Judge. And if the sentencing judge...
You can argue to him that, you know... He really should, now that the guidelines are advisory, you ought to consider, you know, this defendant was weaned too early or something like that. If he wants to, he can hear evidence on that. If he doesn't, he doesn't.
He can hear evidence on the limited remand. If that is the understanding of Palladino, there may not be a difference.
Well, he can decide to resentence. If he thinks that a proper sentence in the new post-Booker regime warrants his or requires him to consider additional evidence, then that would be presented at the new sentencing hearing.
I think that understanding, if that's what Palladino provides for, would be sufficient.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rubenstein. Mr. Nash?
Thank you, Judge. Michael Nash. I represent Bonnie Legilio. Her issues are completely different from her co-defendants. She's charged and convicted only in count 17, although she was originally charged in the money laundering conspiracy, racketeering conspiracy, and the other charges. The first point I'd like to make is that she challenges none of the testimony offered by the government. Literally, there is no evidence against her, save the fact that her name, her purported signature, appears on 300 or so checks, of which the government offered no evidence that she signed any of them, cashed any of them, had any of them, no fingerprints, no testimony of any kind. If your honors look at compare the signatures in the appendix in my brief, A and B, those are forgeries. In C, the government argues that that's her signature. Those are the checks. They are precisely alike to the naked eye, and they offered no testimony. If you look at the forgeries in Appendix A and compare them with the forgery in Appendix D, and this is all according to the government's evidence, those two forgeries are totally different.
So you're saying there was a failure of proof?
There was an absolute failure of proof. And the judge's post-trial ruling wrongly construed the evidence. On page 8, he says that his vague recollection is that Taylor testified that Bonnie Legilio cashed Plaza Partner checks at the currency exchange and dispensed the cash to him for John Legilio. There is no such evidence. I pointed that out in my brief. The government makes no response in its brief.
What are the checks you wanted us to look at?
The checks are at Appendix D.
Did you say D?
C, excuse me.
Yeah.
And those are, according to the government's argument, but no evidence, her signature. Yet you look at the Appendix A and B, and those, according to the government's evidence, are forgeries. Then compare the forgeries in Appendix A and B with the forgery, again according to the government's evidence, in Appendix D, and the forgeries are entirely different.
Wait, you're saying A and B are the same or different?
A and B are both forgeries.
And
C is, according to the government's argument, but no evidence, her signature.
And you're saying it looks just like A.
They look exactly alike to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the forgeries in A and B are different than the forgeries in D. That's the government's evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, Judge, the misconduct by the government in its rebuttal argument, telling the jury, without any evidence, that an expert will not testify or authenticate copies. There was no evidence. That statement is inaccurate. It makes no defense for its conduct. For that reason alone, Your Honors ought to reverse the case.
Where are the originals?
Pardon me?
What happened to the originals?
Judge, I do not know.
The
record is certainly silent as that. They choose to introduce the copies.
But the checks would have gone back to the drawer.
The checks did go back. And the only thing
What happened to them?
The originals?
Yeah.
Well, the originals were never introduced in evidence. The government chose to introduce copies, not originals.
But don't the defendants have the originals?
I don't know where the originals are, and the record is silent.
Well, the originals would go back to whoever wrote the check. I mean, presumably go back to Bonnie, right?
Why presume that? There's nothing in the record to that.
Well, I mean, it's her signature. Even if it's forged, you'd think the bank would look at it, and if it paid the check, you know, it's, say this is Bonnie Lagilio's, and it would send it back to her, wouldn't it?
Judge, I argued a month ago here, and I was chastised by a member of this panel about referring to outside the record. I can't answer that question without doing so. But the fact is, the government has the burden of proof here, not the defendant. Mm-hmm. They chose to introduce the copies.
Well, wait.
And whether they chose
to have the originals, right? The
why didn't they get them?
Excuse me?
They have the burden of proof.
No. How did they get the originals? You mean by subpoenaing them?
They could, certainly.
From you?
From whomever?
Clients?
From the defendant?
Perhaps John Lagilio had them. Why should we presume Bonnie did?
Well, okay.
The judge concluded in his post-trial opinion that the evidence was sufficient for the jury to find that John signed all the checks. If that's the case, what are we doing here? They had as much right to find John found him as Bonnie found him. That's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nash. Mr. Dershowitz?
May it please the court. In the few minutes that I have, I would like to spend it pointing the court's attention to various parts of the record which support our position, particularly on the issue of the suppressed minutes. We want to focus on the January 6th.
Who do you represent?
Oh, I'm sorry, Betty Maltese. And the minutes were excluded based on objections by another defendant who was acquitted. And we want to focus on the January 6th minutes, which were not amended and which were taken by somebody who was an enemy of Maltese and which purported to contain a statement by DiCicchio himself, one of the defendants in the case. And the judge nonetheless excluded that, even though he said that Moros, having written down arguably on his own volition this statement that DiCicchio was said to have made, he excluded it because he said they were self-serving. And in doing so, he applied the wrong standard of hearsay. You can't exclude something based on hearsay if you don't believe the defendant was accurate in having made the statement. The government vouched for those statements. They came in originally, they were sought to be introduced by the government itself, and it was only a co-defendant who kept them out, claiming Confrontation Clause violation. The court was in a pickle, Your Honor. It had failed to give a severance. This was a zero-sum ruling. DiCicchio's lawyer acknowledged that these minutes are likely to be very important to our client's defense. And in fact, he said, I doubt the judge will exclude them for that reason. The judge had many options. He could have granted a severance. He could have admitted it with an instruction saying it can only be used in favor of Maltese but not against DiCicchio. Instead, he ruled that evidence which was not hearsay, because the unamended minutes were a clear exception to the rule. They were official minutes taken by the town, including a statement made by the defendant himself, which was extremely exculpatory of our client, was excluded. And the government does not argue harmless error. They waive any harmless error argument. And if, in fact, this evidence was not harmless error and was prejudicial and was excluded solely because the judge failed to give a severance, it seems to me that conclusively establishes both of our propositions. Number one, that a severance should have been granted, that failure to give a severance excluded relevant evidence that was not harmless error, and second, that the failure to admit the evidence was in itself
error. What happened to DiCicchio?
He got acquitted. It was a zero-sum game. He wins. My client loses. The government says in its brief that Maltese may have stood a better chance of acquittal at a separate trial is not a reason to sever. Well, of course it is, especially when if she had gotten the evidence admitted, which she was constitutionally entitled to, she would have a better chance of acquittal. You can't balance by saying, I have two defendants in front of me, one of whom has a right, the other of whom has a right. I'm going to subordinate one right to another right. So we think that alone, in the absence of a harmless error argument, which was waived, requires a reversal for our client.
I thought the judge regarded the minutes as unreliable.
Well, there are two sets of minutes. There were sets of minutes that were amended, And he said they were unreliable because they were amended. This set of minutes was not amended at all. Uh-huh. It was done by Mr. Morrow, who was an enemy of the defendant, and it contained a statement purporting to be made by Mr. DiCicchio. That couldn't be unreliable. What I think the judge meant, and he misunderstood the nature of that exception, is that he didn't believe it was true. That's a jury issue. They were reliable. The government concedes, and they're stuck with that concession, that there is no evidence that they were unreliable. That is, that they were not copied and transcribed properly. And that's the only criteria under the rule that we sought admission. One more minute on honest services. This court, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook ruled that for honest services to be constitutional, there must be some specific quid pro quo gain. The quid pro quo pointed to by the government is a continuing 20% addition to medical benefits that pre-existed. Now, you can't have a quid pro quo if she would have obtained this personal gain and if others who were not part of the conspiracy obtained the same perks without the alleged misuse of her position. That's not a quid pro quo. The judge himself acknowledged this. He said, quote, if 100% pre-existed the conspiracy, that would tend to rebut and arguably completely rebut any quid pro quo argument. And it seems to me that you can't argue that a pre-existing benefit that was given to everybody is the reason the quid pro quo. And under Judge Easterbrook's ruling,
it wasn't given to everybody.
Say that again?
It wasn't given to everybody.
Well, no, no, no. Everybody who was in a leadership position. And the record makes reference to exactly who it was given to and who it wasn't given to, and when it started and when it stopped. And it can't, therefore, be a quid pro quo. And my final point, if it's not a, even if it were a quid pro quo, a minor quid pro quo, and let's assume she benefited for a few hundred dollars, she had a forfeiture of $3 million. And that forfeiture does not represent her gain or anyone else's gain that she is responsible for. Remember, the jury in this case did not find joint and several liability. What the jury found is that she specifically was responsible for $3.25 million. That is a fine. That is a penalty. What it means is the government can now go and take her home that her 85-year-old mother and her 8-year-old daughter are living in. That home was not obtained as the result of any proceeds, any gain. The court and the jury completely confused a fine, which is punitive, restitution, which is to compensate for losses, and forfeiture, which is simply to disgorge. You can't disgorge something that was not gained or benefited. Mm-hmm. Remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much. So we'll hear from the government. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, in order for a trial court to grant a motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, the defendants must show that the evidence was newly discovered, that it couldn't have been discovered earlier with due diligence, that the evidence is material in the sense that it goes directly to guilt or innocence and is not merely impeaching or cumulative, and that at a new trial with this new evidence, the result would probably be different. The district court denied the motion regarding Frank Taylor's substance abuse because the new evidence met only the first criterion. The court found that if Taylor had actually been impaired during the course of the crime, at least some of the defendants would have known about it or should have known about it, and that there wasn't due diligence. But more importantly, I think, at best, this new evidence is only impeaching. And the district court didn't even think it would have been admissible for that, because substance abuse is admissible as impeachment only if impairment during the time of the events that the witness is testifying about is genuinely an issue. It's not admissible just to muddy up the witness. Okay? Now, the substance abuse here that was alleged was not, it doesn't go to impairment.
Well, Mr. Lapum was arguing that the judge didn't give him a chance to explore the evidence bearing on, you know, when Taylor was under the influence of drugs?
Well, again, the point here is that at best, the evidence is impeaching. And in newly discovered impeachment evidence...
If someone were high, you know, while testifying, or if he testified to a matter during a period when he was in a sanitarium, you know, getting detoxified, that would certainly be powerful impeachment.
That could be powerful impeachment, but the court found that based on his observations of
he didn't observe Taylor during any events to which Taylor testified, right?
That's true.
Right. So how did he? So without an evidentiary hearing, how could he determine whether Taylor could have observed the events he testified to, or was he so muddled with drugs that he wouldn't be a reliable witness?
Well, Your Honor, again, based on the court's observation of him at the trial and his testimony...
Well, you can't, by looking at a person at a trial, figure out what he was under the influence of years earlier, right?
Well, that's true. But, again, you know, the defendants at trial had no basis and admitted that they had no good faith basis to question Taylor's sobriety at any other time than the early 1980s, when John Legilio launched this aspect of his cross-examination of Taylor. He was asking about the early 1980s, and he admitted that he had no good faith basis to question whether or not Taylor had been under the influence at all during the 90s. It came out during the colloquy with counsel in the court that Taylor had gone into a treatment program in the early 1980s, mm-hmm. and that the defendants had absolutely no evidence or no basis for believing that he was anything other than sober during the entire time of the fraud. Mm-hmm. Now, the district court also found that even if this evidence that the defendants had would have been admitted at a new trial, the result of the trial would have been the same. The court found, and I'm quoting here, that it was highly improbable that at a new trial with this evidence, the result would have been different. I'd like to talk a little bit about the district court's ruling on the disputed minutes.
Well, what about the checks? The Bonnie Legilio checks.
I'll turn to that, Your Honor.
What about the statement in rebuttal that experts can't make comparisons off the copies?
Well, there was an objection to that. It was sustained immediately, and more than that. The district court told the jury there was no such evidence either way and that they should disregard the comment. I think also, Your Honors, that the comment that the prosecutor made actually, I think, had as much potential to hurt the government as anything else, because on the one hand, we're telling the jury that, you know, we're asking them to compare Bonnie Legilio's known signature exemplars against photocopies of checks and to find beyond a reasonable doubt that she signed those checks without benefit of an expert opinion. And then comes this comment that an expert won't venture an opinion based on photocopies. I think that has potential to hurt the government as well. So I don't think that it was prejudicial. The district court found that it wasn't prejudicial, and the district court also found or noted that in looking at the exemplars and comparing it to the copies of the checks, it looked to him like Bonnie had signed those checks. Juries are allowed to make comparisons based on handwriting without an expert opinion and to make findings based on that. We asked the jury to do that in this case, and they convicted.
Well, Mr. Nash says that you admit that it was equally likely that John Legilio put these signatures on, and so could you be more specific? So he has all these checks in his appendixes.
Your Honor, there were literally hundreds of questioned documents that the jury was asked to compare to the known signature exemplars of Bonnie Legilio. Mr. Nash has his opinion about what a comparison of a few of those documents might lead to, and the jury had its
opinion. Well, he says in this, her signature in Appendix A is a known forgery. Is that correct?
I don't have the Appendix A in front of me, but I'll take his word for it. There were some signatures that were known to be forgeries.
And don't they look identical to... Are there any that are known to be hers? Presumably there are some.
Well, yeah, we had her known exemplars.
Right. So the jury was what? It was handed hundreds of checks and they had
Bonnie's.
They had
Bonnie's known exemplars, and they also had documents that were known to be forgeries. And they were asked to make the comparison. Pardon me?
So they had three groups, you're saying.
That's correct.
And they just looked at them. Did you help them during the trial? I mean, did you have pictures and show this looks like that? Is that how you did it?
They were blown up and displayed during the trial.
That was how.
Not all of them, I don't think, right, but at least some of them were.
Now, is there any other evidence of Bonnie Legilio's guilt, or is it just the checks?
Well, it's not just the checks, Your Honor. There was a handwriting expert did testify and compared the known exemplars to signatures on, for instance, some of the documents pertaining to the Crown Point Horse Farm, which Plaza Partners was the nominal purchaser, and also some documents regarding the golf course, again, Plaza Partners being the nominal purchaser. And the expert testified that, in fact, on some of those documents, that was Bonnie's signature, gave it as his opinion that was Bonnie's signature. She is at least nominally one of the principals in the Plaza Partners partnership. Her signatures are, we contend, and the jury found, we think, on a lot of documents, on her tax returns, and again, the handwriting expert compared her known exemplars to at least one signature on a 1040 and found that it was hers. She's claiming Plaza Partners' income on there.
Now, was any effort made to procure the originals of the checks?
I don't know the answer to that.
Presumably the checks were returned to the drawer. That's what banks usually do, or maybe they don't return them anymore. Maybe that's...
I know in my own case, I don't get my checks returned to me.
It doesn't give you back.
Not now, anyway. In the mid-90s, I think maybe, but not now.
Okay. Okay, well, you can move on to the minutes then.
Thank you. Loren Maltese contends that there perhaps might have been some confusion on the district court's part regarding the January 6th minutes because they weren't amended. As we contend in our brief, the district court clearly understood that, but he put them in the same category as the amended minutes because in the January 6th minutes, it's reported that DiCicchio announces that no payments have been made to SRC since October. That comment is apropos of nothing that occurred at that meeting according to those minutes, and that's why the district court treated it as suspicious. The January 6th minutes and the amended minutes, the court found, were not made in the ordinary course, and that's why he kept them out. He said that specifically on the record. Loren Maltese's argument...
Not made in what sense? In the sense of being irregular and cooked or something like that? Or
precisely.
Not part of the procedure?
No. The district court believed that the minutes were not...
Usually made in ordinary course means, you know, you have a you have some routine, you're accustomed to have minutes of board meetings, and so there's a secretary or someone who takes those minutes. That seems like a different issue from whether the minutes are honest.
The district court thought that the minutes were dishonest. He thought.
But what Mr. Dershowitz said was that's a credibility issue for the jury. That's not an admissibility issue.
Well, the minutes are only admissible as a public record if there are no indicia of untrustworthiness. That's in the rule. And the district court found indicia of untrustworthiness, found that Loren Maltese was in a position and had the power to influence what went into the minutes and what went into amended minutes, and that those events occurred after the scandal had gone public at a time when she was motivated to protect herself and cast blame elsewhere. That's why the court kept them out.
Could I ask you a couple of questions about the cross-appeal? Now, your idea is that this, what, SRC was a financial institution?
Yes.
Even though it didn't... Wasn't it just a claims processor rather than a firm that bore financial risk or made loans? It wasn't really... processing insurance claims is a different function from insuring, isn't it?
That's true. But the rule, the guideline does contemplate that similar entities are included within the definition.
I don't know why processing is a similar entity. I don't get the similarity. I mean, I thought the notion was that financial institutions are vulnerable, and a fraud against a financial institution can cause all sorts of turmoil. People lose their insurance protection. There's a run on the bank. But that isn't a danger when you're dealing with just a claims processor.
I disagree, Your Honor. The reason that SRC is a similar entity, similar to an insurance company, is because the failure of SRC would have a very similar impact. It would not just be the company that went down if the company went down. You would also have this impact on the vendors who provided medical services and the covered employees of the town of Cicero, because the money to pay those medical claims has already been given by the town of Cicero. What money the town has to pay those claims has been given to SRC, and it's been diverted to other things. And if SRC goes down...
Sounds like on that view, a courier is a financial institution. Anybody who moves money between one place and another and could steal it in between would be a financial institution. So the Brinks truck carrying a bag of silver dollars would be a financial institution, on your view?
No, Your Honor, because, again, I'm looking at the definition.
Well, now I'm lost. The rationale you gave in answer to Judge Posner's question was essentially that the intermediary could steal the money and force the city to pay again, which it might not be able to do. That would be equally true of the Brinks truck driver.
But, Your Honor, I don't think that the Brinks truck driver, the courier, fits in to any part of the definition a financial institution in the commentary.
Well, your response was that a claims processor was a similar institution.
And
I don't know why. The reason you gave for being similar was that it was an intermediary. I gave you another intermediary, and you say, well, that's not similar. Other than I know it when I see it, I'm not sure that I understand the ground on which you think something is similar or not.
Well, Your Honor, again, turning to the definition in the commentary, it says that a financial institution is to include any insurance company or health, medical, or hospital insurance association and any similar entity. I think that SRC, as an insurance claims processor, particularly for medical insurance,
well,
is a similar entity.
We are... Similar in what respect? One could be similar in the sense that there is risk pooling or financial intermediation going on, which there is not with a claims processor, or it could be similar in the sense that it is handling funds, right? Now, this is not similar in the sense of being a financial intermediary. It is similar in the sense of handling funds. Well, that's why I gave you the Brink Trucks driver, who is also similar in the sense of handling funds.
But no, I think this is a
then
financial...
You said handling funds is not the right sense of similarity.
I think this is a financial intermediary because SRC takes the money from Cicero to pay the medical claims. They're an intermediary between the vendor...
Let me ask you a different question, which is, do you want to pursue the cross-appeal after Booker? If you succeed on any aspect of the cross-appeal, instead of there being a limited Palladino remand, there'll be a vacator and a straight remand with instructions to resentence. And, of course, at the resentencing, Judge Grady can give the very same sentence he did, if not a lower one, saying that I am no longer bound by the strict terms of the guidelines, and your cross-appeal is based on these strict terms of the guidelines. all I have to do is give a reasonable sentence. I think my last sentence was reasonable, QED. Or a lower sentence would be reasonable.
Yeah, we've considered this very carefully, Your Honor, and we're prepared to take our chances. We are pursuing the cross-appeal.
I have another question. It has to do with it. Well, I have two questions. One is, now, what is the thinking under which the Maltese is hit with this large potential? Is this restitution that you're seeking? Is that the...
It's RICO forfeiture. It's RICO forfeiture.
So what is the theory under which she is liable, even though she didn't receive much of those proceeds?
The theory is that RICO forfeiture is joint and several liability. And there was an argument made this morning that the jury wasn't properly told that, but there's been no argument in the briefs that the jury was improperly instructed at the forfeiture stage.
Okay, well, let me ask you another question about the forfeiture. Now, the theory presumably, is this the theory, because I was unclear about this, the theory is, or should be, that this SRC, it did a function that the city needed. Right, it needed a claims process.
Correct.
So it hires SRC, which is a corrupt organization, and SRC overcharges. So presumably the proceeds would be the difference between what SRC got and what a legitimate claims processor would have gotten. Isn't that correct? Isn't that what net proceeds are?
Well, for purposes of the fraud loss calculation, the government did net out from the loss what SRC actually paid out in medical benefits to the vendors. The district court then required...
Well, no, but there's also a processing fee that the town would have had to pay to a legitimate claims processor.
That's correct, and the district court required us to net that out of the
right.
fraud loss, too.
Well, I don't. But your argument, I think, as I understood it, is you shouldn't net out the actual costs that SRC incurred because that would reward the inefficient. That was your argument. They would have a lesser forfeiture. But I would think the thing to net out would be the processing fee that the town would have had to pay to a legitimate claims processor. Otherwise, there's a windfall.
Well, I think essentially that's what we did, again, for purposes of the fraud loss calculation. And
why? I'm now puzzled because I read your brief as saying that you didn't have to net that out.
We didn't think we should have had to, but the district court asked us to, and we came up with a figure.
So it's your view that the actual forfeiture award does net out what, say, Nationwide, the prior claims processor, would have charged given their actual schedule of fees, which we know?
Your Honor, I can't answer that question. There's a little bit of confusion here, I think, at least on my part. I'm talking about the fraud loss calculation, and I think the court is talking about how the forfeiture figure was arrived at. And I'm afraid I can't tell you exactly how the forfeiture different defendants were ordered to forfeit different amounts.
But what's you're appealing on some what are you appealing?
We're appealing on the fraud loss calculation for purposes of the guidelines at sentencing.
Okay, but why isn't that the same? That is the loss to the city is the difference between what it paid SRC and the lower amount that it would have had to pay a legitimate claims process. That lower amount would include a processing fee.
That's correct.
And is that how you want to do it or how the district court did it?
How the district court required us to do it.
Right, and what's wrong with that?
Well, for one thing, we think that that Cicero certainly didn't receive value for the money that they
paid. Well, it received some value, surely. Right? I mean, someone had to pay these claims.
Some claims were processed.
Right,
So
why wouldn't not only those claims not be part of the fraud loss, the claims actually paid, But the reasonable processing fee necessary to pay those claims would also be something that was not a fraud loss, because you would have had to pay that anyway.
Well, but
right, $21 million or so of claims were paid, something like that.
I think it was more like 18, but
or 18
something
million
like
claims
that, yeah.
are paid, and if you'd had a legitimate claims processor, that claims processor obviously would have charged, I don't know, 10% or something to pay them.
Well,
so you weren't defrauded of that
Well. I think the town had a loss there because, see, the figure that we arrived at for the costs that we then netted out was based on industry averages or practices in the industry. But the service that Cicero got from SRC was far below industry averages. And the town ended up having to borrow money to keep up the payments to SRC, and they paid interest on those loans. So the city went to a lot of trouble.
I understand. Well, certainly those additional interest costs and so on would be part of the fraud loss. I understand that. But it seems to me that the proper method of calculation is simply to subtract what the total costs, processing and so on, that Cicero would have had to pay a legitimate claims processor, and the actual costs, including these indirect, you know, interest rates and so on, that Cicero had to pay SRC. Isn't that the logical way to calculate the loss?
Well, when the government did that and submitted its numbers to the court, we still came up with in excess of $10 million of loss, and that's the dividing line for purposes of a guideline adjustment. The district court nevertheless found that the loss was less than $10 million. And the only explanation...
No, that seems to me to be very questionable, what the district court said, you know, rounding down or something like that. That I don't understand. But are you saying that if we correct that ruling by the judge when he reduced the $10.6 million below $10 million just because he thought, you know, maybe there's variance, you know, there's uncertainty. If we correct that, then you wouldn't have any further quarrel with how the loss was calculated. Is that, you just want to get it over $10 million, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
So, do any of the defendants' counsels wish to rebut?
Wish to keep going.
Mr. Lapuma?
Judge, I would briefly address the government's contention that the defendants admitted during the trial that there was no good faith basis for an inquiry of Taylor. And I would refer the court to the trial transcripts at 2273 to 2275, where it was indicated the counsel was trying to make a record on this point and did not know what Taylor would say. Your Honors, we twice were denied an opportunity to explore Taylor's mental capacity and ability to recollect, and we respectfully request this court to vacate the judgments and remand this matter for a new trial.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. LaPorte. Mr. Rubenstein or Mr. Nash? Either or both.
Your Honor, Judge Posner asked the government if it helped the jury regarding the signatures. It chose not to show the expert any of the checks in question. That did not show them any, did not ask her opinion regarding those checks. Second, it was not my saying that the evidence offered by the government would allow the jury to find that John signed all the checks. That's on page 10 of Judge Grady's post-trial ruling on the motion, which is Appendix H to our brief, in the second paragraph. He says, from this evidence, having recited the government's evidence, the jury could have concluded that John signed Bonnie's name to all the Plaza Partner checks as well. Not mine, the district court. Mm-hmm. And last, the government put two co-defendants, intimate involvees, in the crimes that they charged. Neither of those witnesses said a thing about Bonnie Lagilio that we dispute. They didn't say really anything. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nash. Mr. Dershowitz?
I'd like to limit my comments to correcting the record, particularly in reference to the January 6th minutes, which Your Honor inquired about. The January 6th minutes were totally trustworthy. The judge refused them on completely different grounds. Indeed, not only are the minutes trustworthy, we sought to show the judge the actual handwritten notes, and the contemporaneous handwritten notes say what the minutes say about the crucial statement attributed to the defendant, DiCicco. There is simply no conceivable basis for keeping out those minutes.
Your argument is they were kept out only because they mentioned DiCicco.
The judge says that. I think the confrontation problem applies to the Morrow statement as well as to the other statements in these so-called amended minutes. If Morrow is the confrontation clause problem, it probably is. If Morrow is going to take the Fifth Amendment, obviously he can't be cross-examined. It was purely a confrontation clause issue. And you can't keep out one defendant's admissible evidence based on the claim that another defendant has a confrontation clause argument.
Didn't you just say, though, on the amended minutes?
Unamended minutes.
I thought you said amended.
I'm sorry. No, these are the unamended minutes. January 6th, unamended, pristine, taken down by hand by Morrow, and containing statements by a defendant against his own interests. There's no conceivable basis for keeping them out. The government does not argue harmless error. These were devastating. These were zero-sum, devastating minutes. As far as the forfeiture is concerned, just one correction. We did argue. We made an objection to the forfeiture, an objection. It appears in our brief and in the appendix at page 464 to 469. The court instructed the jury that each defendant can have individual forfeitures, not joint and several, and then the jury confused a forfeiture with a restitution because there was no evidence to suggest that Loreen Maltese earned $3,200,000 and they're going to take away her house and her child's house, which have nothing to do with this case. That's not forfeiture. That's a fine. That's restitution. But a forfeiture is disgorgement. And the argument about joint and several doesn't work because the Masters case, what happened is all the defendants received bribes, and there was only joint and several liability as to the bribes, and there was a single jury verdict in that case saying what the total amount of forfeiture was. Each of them had the same amount. In this case, each had a different amount, and it violates the rule of Masters.
Let me ask you one question, or any of the other lawyers can answer it. It has to do with this $10.6 million, the rounding down. I didn't understand that. I mean, what Judge Grady seemed to think was that of course, there's an error term in any of these calculations. But if there's no bias, then I don't understand why the judge would shave off the $600,000.
Your Honor, I can only offer my answer. Yeah. It doesn't affect my client particularly, but it seems to me under the post-Booker fan-fan, it's utterly irrelevant because the judge under post-Booker fan-fan can simply say, look, it's close enough to below $10 million. I'm going to follow the guidelines, but in a close case under principles of lenity because the considerations were so vague, I'm going to act under the guidelines as if it were below $10 million. So I think it becomes moot post-guideline, Your Honor.
Mr. Rubenstein? Yes, thank you, Mr. Mister. Did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, thank you, Judge. This also, I don't think, affects Mr. Schneider, although I'll give an answer with respect to all the defendants. But the judge did also, after arriving at that figure, make foreseeability determinations as to certain of the defendants. And with respect to Mr. Schneider and I think one other, the judge found that in any case, because of the timing of their participation in the conspiracy, the number would be well below $10 million. And I don't think the government disputes that. As to the number itself, there were disputed, I shouldn't say disputed, there were varying figures relating to what kinds of fees or what percentages the town would have had to pay to other claims processors and other vendors. And those numbers varied depending on the time of the conspiracy, depending on the nature of the services provided. And because it was a summary sentencing proceeding, the judge decided on a number, but I think at the end of the day, when it found that it was slightly over the threshold amount, said, it could have been higher fees paid under different schemes or different different scenarios. And because of that, and because there's really no pressing reason to make those kind of very subtle determinations, I'm going to find that the town's loss was lower than that threshold amount. And I think that's what the judge did.
Okay, thank you very much. And now, did you want to say something, Mr. Nash?
Well,
no. Okay. So if I'm correct, Mr. LaPuma and Mr. Nash were appointed?
No.
No. Were you all retained? Okay.
We're in an unusual situation. We don't know whether we're doing this pro bono or not.
Right. Okay, well, we thank you very much for your efforts and for the government's efforts.
No one has asked that you personally be forfeited or anything like that, I trust.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We'll move on to the next case, which is United States.